Hey friends, Kate here. Just letting you know that there is a little bit of a content warning for this episode. We discuss issues like suicide and war and violence and some of those current issues that are happening today in the world. And so if any of that feels too heavy, we try to leave you with some hope. But if any of that feels too heavy for you today, we totally get it. And this may be an episode to skip for you. And then we'll catch you next time when Untidy Faith wraps up our season on 1 Samuel with a little recap of how we're feeling and doing. So thanks for joining us for this ride, and I'll talk to you soon. You're listening to the Untidy Faith podcast, where we have honest conversations and gentle encouragement for when following Jesus gets messy. I'm your host, Kate Boyd, author, speaker, and gentle guide for Christians who are disentangling their faith from culture and desiring to find joy in following Jesus again. There can be life of faith after deconstruction. Let's find yours together. This season, you get to be a fly on the wall as I and my co-hosts, Robert Callahan and Amanda Waldron, read through 1 Samuel together and give you our honest thoughts, questions, and takeaways. Let's get to it. All right, guys, welcome. We are, actually finishing 1 Samuel, if you can believe it. And I'm here with Robert and Amanda, who've been on this journey with me.
Hey. What a journey. What a book.
I know. It's been a wild ride. Yeah, I mean, everything from, what have we covered? Foreskins and ghosts and wars and idol. Like, there's so much happening here. We were just saying that the book ends sort of on a sad note, so yeah. Be prepared to not be happy at the end of this story. It's not the most hopeful.
Good thing you changed the name of this podcast.
Yeah, I know. It's not happy and holy anymore.
We
are deeply in untidy territory today.
Sad and sadistic.
Yeah, I know. Just horribly depressed because the Bible is sometimes really sad. Yeah, let's jump in. Chapter 30. Robert, you're going to recap for us what's happening with David.
Yeah, so remember at the end of the last chapter, the armies that were with the king that David was effectively the bodyguard for said, "We're not okay with David being with us. He's not one of us. Send him back." So David and his men are heading back to Ziklag, and they get there, and lo and behold, they discover that the Amalekites have come, and they have burned the city to the ground. Everyone's gone. They've been taken captive, all the women, all the children, all of the spoils and the livestock have been taken. And so the men are in this really deep state of mourning. And the Bible also mentions here that David's two wives, who are named, which is great, Abigail and Ahinoam, have also been taken. So the men are distressed, they're disgruntled, and they start grumbling. And they're like, "We should stone David. This is his fault."
We're over this.
I mean, the fickle crowd.
And so David needs some guidance. So he has the priest bring the ephod. And I am incorporating into my understanding of this what you taught us, Kate, earlier on, which is that the ephod had the different jewels in it and that one of them was essentially a dye.
Yeah.
Like a chance.
That sounds right.
None of a thing.
That's what I was trying to remember. I should have looked it up, but yeah, that sounds right. Like the lots or whatever are inside the ephod to find their fate.
So they're rolling for initiative.
Exactly. It's just like really high stakes Dungeons and Dragons.
Do we plunder? Yes, you do. So the question that David lays before God is, would we be successful if we go to rescue the city, basically? And the answer is yes. I do want to pause here for a second. This is a pretty niche battle scar from evangelical Christianity. There was a sermon series that got preached at a church that I was at one time that was built kind of like in the same way. I don't know if y'all remember the prayer of Jabez. This very prosperity gospel kind of feely, you know, three small steps to success. So in King James, the translation here is that the Lord basically says, pursue, overtake, and recover all. That's me surmising it based on the themes that were in the sermon series that was preached. And I just cannot read this chapter without just that being like sunk in my head. And it's just a very name it and claim it, very not healthy understanding of, you know, how God operates in our lives. So anyway, God says, go pursue them. And so David takes his 600 men, 200 of them are just worn out because, I mean, it's the desert in the Middle East and all that. So 200 of them stay with the supplies, 400 of them cross, they go find or go to pursue the Amalekites. They end up crossing a field, finding an Egyptian slave who was sick. He was left behind by his master, who was an Amalekite. And David basically butters them up. They treat him really well. They feed him. They help him to recover. And then they're like, hey, how'd you end up here? And he's like, yeah, my boss, who's my owner, who's an Amalekite, just got done raiding all these areas, including Ziklag. And David's like, huh, you know how we just took care of you? Would you be cool just kind of, you know, I don't know, showing us which direction they went? And so the Egyptian's like, yeah, just, you know, don't kill me or narc on me or anything like that. So they find the Amalekites. They're literally fat, dumb, and happy. They're just engorged from the spoils of all their different victories. And so David fights with them basically 24 hours from dusk till evening the next day. And the Bible says none got away except for 400 who got on camels. It's very specific.
Except maybe these 400 guys.
I know. It's like nobody got away. I mean, there were these people, but who cares about them? It's such a weird phrase.
I know that camels can run, but like you just don't think of that, you know? Like,
yeah. I don't know. They don't seem like fast animals.
I'm picturing like this low speed chase. Anyway, so at this point, this starts to feel, I don't know if you guys caught this or if this even resonates with you, but the movie 300, which is about the nod, no, Amanda, no, I don't know what that's, but this is just the,
I've never heard of it, don't know what you're talking about.
it feels very much like this small cadre of people that are going after this larger quantity of people and just overcoming incredible odds. So David fights with them. No one gets away except for the 400 that get away on camelback. And they recover everything. And they're very specific here in 1 Samuel to name everything that's recovered, the sheep, the two wives of David. And so then they are returning back to Ziklag. And they encounter the 200 that, remember, were left behind with the supplies. And the 400 start grumbling. And they're like, look, we were out there. We stuck out our necks. We were fighting in the heat of the day. We're not sharing. And David's like, no, we're not going to do that. And this reminds me, by the way, of the New Testament, of the story of the field owner that hires the workers and he gives them all the same wages, but then there's some that come later in the day and there's grumbling by the ones that are there working throughout the whole day. And he basically says, this is my money. I do with it with what I want to. So David essentially codifies this rule as a means of saying like, look, we're all part of the team here. We all did something. The people that were left behind who were guarding the supplies are just as integral to the team as the people that were out fighting in the heat of the battle. So from now on, it's going to be a rule that we all split the proceeds. And he specifically says, the Lord protected and gave into our hands our enemies. And so the plunder is also shared with the elders in the community, who I note were David's friends, and then in neighboring communities as well. And that is essentially chapter 30.
Yeah. All right. So, Amalekites, these guys, we can't get rid of these guys either. They're one of the, like, they're recurring characters too.
Yeah.
Because if you like rewind, I think we talked a little bit about this in the last episode, or maybe a couple ago, when we were talking about how like Saul like didn't kill that king or whatever. Right. Like, these are the Amalekites. Like, they didn't take care of him. So it's kind of a mess that Saul made in a way. If you think that not killing people is making a mess, which this book seems think. So if we're operating within its realm, not killing people is bad, and then killing people is good in certain circumstances.
Which makes me want to ask the question as to why David hasn't killed Saul already, but that's neither here nor there. But I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't know. So they come in, attack the people that David has been a mercenary for, essentially. And he's like, oh, I should do something about this, especially because they stole my wife and children. My wives and children. Sorry, that's plural. Plural. He's got sister wives happening. Which I could talk about at length, because I am finally caught up. I watched 18 seasons of Sister Wives in like 4 weeks. It was I was dedicated. So, Amanda, before we get to like him actually fighting, him just sort of like figuring it out and then like heading out on his journey, what sort of strikes you, or what stood out to you in this portion with David?
Yeah, the sense of, even in the midst of people being like, hey, should we stone you? God is still calling on, right? Like, these ways of speaking with the Lord. I also think, what a bummer, right? Like, first you get called up to go potentially fight your kinsmen. And then you're like, they're like, get out of here, go home. You get home, everything's gone. The town that you were given, burnt to the ground, right? Like, it feels like, I mean, David can catch a break, but it also feels like he can't catch a break.
Sure. I mean, we can see that they're clearly exhausted, right? Like, some of them are like, we cannot. Right. We will sit here and we'll watch your bags. Yeah, we can't do it.
Which is funny, right? Because I don't think in that first pass through does it say what those 200 men are doing, but then on the return, they're like, oh yeah, they were watching the supplies.
Yeah, we left them there to hang out and make sure everything was fine. It's okay. Yeah. No big deal.
I think I'd want to be in that supply group.
Yeah, I would definitely. I mean, to be fair, I'm a woman, so I probably would have been stolen. Yeah. So I don't really have a choice in the situation as to how I participate in the story. But I did, I'd be like, well, you know, I'll just stay here. You guys go ahead. You're doing great. I'll keep an eye. Don't worry.
I twisted my ankle.
Yeah. Or do the little, you know, little cough.
Black lung.
Yeah, our little Zoolander black lung cough. Yeah, I mean, what are you thinking, Robert?
Yeah, I'm trying to, I have a theme that's sort of brewing, and I want to let it cook a little bit.
Okay.
But I mean, some things that I do latch on to, I do think that it's interesting that, I mean, we just can't get enough of the Amalekites, right? Like, they just keep coming back. And that reminds me of, I mean, it was just within the last year, 2 years, that I started realizing that there's times that the Bible isn't literal. And so if the Bible says, for example, that the Amalekites in one chapter were completely wiped out, or that they were destroyed, utterly destroyed, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's literally saying that they were wiped out or utterly destroyed, because we see them again later.
Right. And yeah,
they keep 400 popping guys up, on so, camels.
Yeah, we know at least 400 of them got away at some point.
That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people to be like nobody.
Yeah. I know. No one survived.
Yeah, like, we thought that we got them, but hail Hydra, they're back again. And so there's a sense that I think hyperbole is being used, and I think that we need to be aware that those things are showing up in our reading of the Bible. And so I think that that's good. I do think that there's something very honorable about the fact that David was willing to share with not just the men who didn't participate with the fighting, but also with those in the greater community from his battle. Like, this would have been his trophies, you know, and it would have been very easy for him to hoard that. It's wealth, it's resources. He has people that he needs to feed, not just in his family, but in his army, in his little group of people. Mm-hmm. And so just the idea that this win belongs to everyone, you know, kind of using football terminology now, this win belongs to everybody. Yeah. I mean, we all took part of the fans. You're great. Thanks to everybody that came out. I think that that's very noble. And so I'm chewing on that right now.
Yeah, it is sort of interesting. So, like, he fights this battle, and we don't get a ton of details about, like, what happens. We just know that it happened, and it was a long time from twilight until the evening of the next day. So, like, 24 hours plus, supposedly, they're fighting, and not one of them escaped, except for... Yeah, and then he somehow recovers all that had been taken. Nothing was missing. Go ahead.
It makes me wonder of what you're saying, Robert, right? Like, that hyperbole of, right? So, like, not one of them escaped. Everything was recovered. Mm-hmm. But I guess, does God say that everything is going to be recovered? So maybe it was. I'm just trying, like, was that hyperbole too, that everything was recovered?
Right.
I can imagine that there's some hyperbole in that. I think it's more of a statement of it was a complete victory, and it was like a decisive victory, and that David is sort of like returning. David is proving himself as a military leader and, in a sense, taking care of what Saul didn't take care of, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at how they're compared, you know, a couple chapters back, Saul can't hear from the Lord. That's why he goes to look for a ghost. David here gets an immediate answer and says he's going to be victorious. And he is victorious over people that Saul was victorious over, but did not do all that the Lord had asked of them. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's, it's part of this like myth making, right? Of David, which is what I really think is happening here. And not to say that it's all fake or anything like that, but there is a sense of like that hyperbolic nature is like feeding into what we're supposed to think about David. And he's kind of at this point, the anti-Saul. He's like the different version. And so whereas Saul continues to fail over and over and over again, and we're going to see it again in a minute, here David is on the upside and is like able to do all the things that Saul wasn't able to do.
Mm-hmm. That's good. You do though hope that there's literal recovery of everything, right?
Yeah. Because
you do hope the people.
Imagine like 99% of the family members returned to everyone except for like Job's wife. And like he's over there and he's like, I just can't get a break, you know?
I know. I'm sorry, bud. It is what it is. You're stuck. I don't know what to tell you. And I also think it's interesting, Robert, in contrast to what you were saying before of like the sermon series you heard on it, that like he does all of these things and he does take back, but then he shares. Yeah. Like it's not something that he does for himself, which, and I didn't hear the sermon series, so I can't say that, but I get this. But there's a sense in which a lot of those, in my experience, at least, have been very like, you can reclaim and you can do this for yourself. And sure, that means that has effects on the world, et cetera. But there's really the sense in which it's sort of, like you said, that prosperity thing, like you claim it and you hold it. Whereas he doesn't do that. He actually like sets a law then to like give to other people who didn't participate in the battle. And then he goes back and gives it to the elders of these communities that he's a part of or been around and who may have been affected by some of the violence as well. And so I think that's a really interesting contrast to what you were saying. You sort of grew up with the message around it.
Yeah, I think you heard that message because
it's just probably under a different title. It sounds like, you know, I think we all heard those.
That's a good word though. That's a good word.
I want to know what happened to this Egyptian after this. Like, where did he end up?
Yeah, I don't know. He just gets to go on his merry way. I hope he didn't get picked up by those like 400.
Hey, I know you.
Like, what if his master was like one of them?
Can't catch a break.
Just can't. He can't do it. It's there. What do we think of the treatment of the Egyptian?
Oh,
did it feel like just like, I don't know. I get so wary of like these very transactional feeling interactions, even though they may have been doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. And then it just sort of discovered that they could use it to their advantage. But I kind of feel like that's probably not what they were thinking.
Right. Yeah. I think it's more that sense of this guy seems to know some things.
Yeah. It feels very usey. I don't know what it is about the language in verse 11. They found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David. They gave him water. It just feels very impersonal. We don't know the Egyptian's name. We don't know, you know, who his master was. So I think that it was very much strategic benefit, but at the same time, I mean, there's the opportunity that was created was also a blessing for the Egyptian who was sick and ill.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can be two things at once, but I mean, they gave
both and it.
Well, and I did read, I was reading and they were talking about how like typically in most ancient Near Eastern law, you had to return slaves to their masters. Like that was like the rule, but that wasn't a rule for Israel. So like had the Egyptian bumped into anybody else, he probably would have been returned. He just happens to bump into people. So I do think, I do think it's sort of like a double-edged sword. It cuts both ways. What were you saying, Amanda?
I also was noticing that verses like 11 and 12 are kind of, or maybe just 12, are reminiscent of how they described all the food in the Abigail story. Like they're really specific with what they give him. A fig cake, two clusters of raisins, water.
Yeah.
Like we got the full menu.
Bread. Yeah. And his spirit revived.
And right, like that, when they were talking about like the fixing of the meal and everything that went into the meal with last week's episode, it just feels like there are these moments where the author is like, I got to put in these really specific details.
Like people really will have questions about the food. I just know it. Let's just go ahead and cover.
What did they feed him?
their freeze. Yeah.
Well, and it makes you wonder, like, if it matters what they're saying, like, if there's some sort of symbolism. Nobody writes about it. So I don't know, but I do sort of.
Does this
like
mean
with
something?
The specificity, like, is because there's the so many things that they don't. Yeah. I was like, because there's so many things that they don't say, you know, in the stories. And so it is sort of weird that they give these like weird specific food details. Although I would eat some fig cake. So bring it on. Yeah. I'll try that. But it's one of those, like, I wonder if there's something about what they're eating. But nobody mentioned it in anything that I read. So I'll have to look it up sometime.
Okay.
And get back to you. I don't really
have
an
answer. Our audience wants to know. What's up with this food?
Why fig cakes? What's up? I don't know.
I mean, it's objectively good, but.
I mean, it sounds good. Like, who doesn't want a Fig Newton? That sounds amazing to me.
Yeah, that actually does sound really good.
Right?
This episode was brought to you by Fig Newton.
Yeah, exactly. New sponsor. It's not a cookie. It's fruit and cake. I don't remember those old commercials. Okay, anything else from chapter 30 and David and the Amalekites before we move on over to Saul and his battle?
Every Saul's battle.
Yes.
Okay. Here we go, guys.
Let's go.
Throwback to a popular book. Okay.
All right. So we're wrapping up the book with this wonderful tale of Saul and his sons.
Guys, what do you think is going to happen to Saul? What do you think would wrap up this story?
All right, Amanda.
And you'll remember the Philistines are on their way to attack Israel. And they do. And in the midst of that, they close in on Saul and they kill his three sons, Jonathan and the other two. and wound Saul. Severely, it says he gets shot and he's with his armor bearer and he asks his armor bearer to kill him. And his armor bearer is conflicted and eventually says, nope, I don't think I will. And then Saul throws himself on his sword and dies. His armor bearer does the same thing. And when the Philistines find him, they take his armor, put it in a temple. And they proclaim the news of Saul's death all over their land. And they take his body and they put it up on a wall of a town. But at some point, some Israelites hear about this. And under the cover of darkness, they go and grab his body and give him a proper burial. And then they fasted for 7 days. The end.
I know. It's such a downer. But it sets you up for the sequel. So yeah. I do at least appreciate that. They're like, they're going to buy the next ticket because they got to know what's happening. This is not how this should end. You know what I mean?
In true Samuel's form, first and second, you get a retelling of Saul's death.
Yeah.
As it starts off. And it's a little bit different than this chapter. So. That's par for the course.
Yeah, that's just how it goes.
But you'll have to read that on your own time.
Okay, Robert, Philistines, Saul.
Yeah.
What you got?
It's giving me Boromir vibes.
It does. It does give Boromir. What do you think about the, like, when there's, so they decapitated him after he was killed. And then there's reference to his body. They fastened his body to the wall, but they don't mention the head. Do you think that they're saying that the body as a whole, like the head maybe is in one place, the body is in another place, but they're in the same edifice? Or do you think that they're saying like the head's gone and we're not going to talk about what happened to it anymore and this is what we're doing to the body?
I got the sense that they took the head and were like parading it around. And therefore it would be separate from the body probably. Like they took his armor and like put it in the temple and then they like, it, they impaled. It sounds like they typically impale bodies. So that's probably what happened. Mm-hmm. They impaled the body as a warning. Maybe they eventually put the head there. Because one thing that did come up was that it was unusual for like cremation to happen. Like that's not a thing that was normally practiced, but that's what these people did for Saul's body when they got it. So that it must have been in pretty bad shape. It must have been pretty mutilated and not good for that to have happened.
Yeah, Amanda, you've really slapped me upside the head with something. So like if there are times when I'm reading The Lord of the Rings or watching the movies and I feel like there's echoes of something and I can't quite grasp what it is. That character has always like there's a weird nobility to him. Right. Mm-hmm. So like there's, you know, he's seduced by the ring and the temptation. Hey, spoiler alert for everyone that hasn't watched Lord of the Rings. You've had 2 decades. There's the sense in which he wants to do the right thing and he has these noble goals, but he's blinded by his own ambition and the temptations and just goes about things the wrong way. And so everything that he does kind of is cursed almost. And so like when he in the movie is finally kind of like coming to his senses in the last moments, he is first taken down by an archer. And there's the moment where he's standing all alone and you think that the enemy's just going to have their way with him. And then Aragorn sweeps in last minute and saves him. And then they have like the exchange at the end, but there's kind of like this, almost like a redemption moment where he's speaking to Aragorn and he's like, you know, like we're brothers and we did this for the glory of Gondor and humanity. And so there's the same sort of feeling here almost. We don't have David standing with Saul there in the moment, but David has this reverence for Saul that we've talked about throughout and is going to be significant later as we're talking about the different versions of the death of Saul. And so like there's this sense of we still have this tie together and that we're still brothers in arms and that there's this sense of nobility and love and appreciation for his heart, even if everything that he did and every way that he went about it was flawed. So very interesting comparison. I'm going to be chewing on that for a while.
And I'm also kind of sad that, right, like Jonathan was such a major character for a portion of this book and that this, there's not even necessarily, I guess there's not a eulogy for any of the people that died in this chapter.
Yeah.
But just that sense of like, what a loss.
Yeah. It feels like there should be a song here.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like this big sad instrumental piece as like the camera pans across the battlefield of everyone who's fallen. That's sort of the feeling you get because it is really heavy. And it's even to the point like Saul knows that if he's captured alive, he's going to essentially be tortured or mutilated in life before being mutilated in death. And so for him, like this is apparently not unusual for people to do if that's the choice facing them at the time, in which case everyone was like, this kind of suicide was not negative at the time. Like it wouldn't have been seen that way. But even then he's like scared to do it. He asks someone else to do it first.
Yeah.
Cause it is so final and tough. And I can't imagine having to make that decision or even being the armor bearer and having to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And then they're both. Yeah. I mean, they both end up dead.
That's just
it's so depressing. Yeah. Like they both just decide to fall upon their swords and die rather than face what could be left of their life in the hands of the Philistines.
Yeah. I feel like if kind of going back to our conversations about stopping and pausing to think about the significance of the violence and who is portrayed against and how it's portrayed. I mean, to really, we don't like to talk about death, period. We certainly don't like to talk about violent death, but to really sit with the very personal, emotional torment that Saul and even his armor bearer would have to be going through in this moment. Like it's too much for the mind to handle, but I feel like it's important that we do.
Yeah. I mean, cause it's very final. It's not even just that. It's a very public failure, especially at like the one thing Saul is supposed to be good at, which is like military. And so to be facing this, to know for sure that God is not with you. And even when you ask Samuel from beyond the grave, what does God have for me? He's like, you already have your answer when you got no answer. And so you're facing like, you know, the arch nemesis, the arch nemesis of your people. And you look out and you're like, there's just no hope here. It's better for me to die because all of my people have died in this battle than it is for me to live or figure out some other thing. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a really heavy end to the story. I mean, not just in the book, but also for Saul. Wow. Because I think in a lot of ways, I relate to Saul and like this chronic insecurity he has that seems to have been sort of his Achilles heel this whole time, which is sort of what has like, what I have seen, and maybe that's just because I have it, that I've like seen how it shows up in his life and how it's affected all of his relationships. And so to be here at the height of failure in every way, and then you're just like, yep, okay. Like, it's so tough when everything is stacked up against you to that point. I just can't imagine, you know, I've had heavy seasons, but this is like, this is next level. This is like everybody gets murdered, you know, on your watch. Yeah. And that's really hard.
Yeah. And your family, right?
Yeah.
And even the indignity of the death itself, because I feel like as I'm trying to put myself in Saul's position in those final moments, I could receive maybe some consolation in that there was someone there beside me to help me in my ending. But even in his decision to end his life, the only person that was standing beside him couldn't help him in that way. And so even in the taking of his own life, it had to manually, he had to do it himself. And that's very different than having someone do it for you.
Yeah.
And it also feels just very, I mean, if you see the enemy closing in on you and, you know, surely they were in a position to have seen this, and just kind of even the indignity of them knowing that in the final moments that it had to be you yourself. Probably, I don't know, we might want to put a warning on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking that too. I was like, man, we keep talking about it and it feels like it feels like people just need to be aware.
Yeah.
Not only of the content, but just that like it's of the specificity of what we're talking about, but also just.
Well,
I'm also struck, go ahead.
I was going to say, it feels heavy in the same way that like world events right now feel. heavy.
Yeah, that's right? Kind like, of where I was going to. I was like, because we're still seeing this conflict, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like these people's, this conflict. And yeah, it's just like, wow, when you're thinking about how it, the violence continues, you know?
Yeah, or you think about this only being in biblical times, right? Like this violence is only mm-hmm. biblical violence versus like, oh no, we're seeing this play out right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because for a refresher, the Philistines are the predecessors of the Palestinians, right, Kate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even some of what we talked about last chapter, they even said like people who occupy Gaza, like people who lived in Gaza specifically. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that that's who they're fighting, like specifically in Gaza right now, but in this part of the book. But I mean, it's definitely this sort of like same conglomeration of people. This like, yeah, that this sort of like butting of heads has been around, you know, since BC, right? Like we're still witnessing the depth of like, not just this conflict, but the emotions that are tied up in it, the consequences of the, you know, the enmity between the two groups of people. Like it just sort of like continues and, and like here it ends very sadly. Well, I guess the Philistines are pleased, but you know, there's a sense in which like, yeah, like, is this worth this? Mm-hmm. And I can't make that call. I don't know. That's a question I keep asking with all the violence in the world. It's like, wow, was that really worth mm-hmm. the taking of life? And it's even at this point where we can take life from a distance to where it's all very personal in the sense of like the conflict feels very personal to the different peoples on their sides. And it's very impersonal the way in which it happens today. And so, yeah, there's like this also weird distance. And I don't know what to do with it. But it just sort of like keeps hitting me the more that like as we continue to be in Samuel or have been, you know, like I didn't necessarily see the conflict there escalating to what we're seeing now in when we started this, you know, months and months and months ago. And so to be ending here in the middle of a war at the same time is very, yeah.
We don't get our American uptick of like, all right, now we're moving into some pleasant things or that like,
yeah.
Right. The triumph of that is supposed to be David that we're just.
Well, kind of and left. Even, yeah. And even the way, and I kept thinking this week, you know, as we've been in this area, like this book and everything that like the ways in which these stories have even been used to justify violence for so many years. And then of course to justify Christian violence against Jewish people, I think there's a lot of that has occurred as well. And so just like how powerful these stories can be and how powerful and how careful we need to be with how we handle them and draw conclusions from them. Especially being so far removed from the particular circumstances, but also just, I don't know, I just find myself really thinking about like how I have used scripture in not, you know, physically violent ways or to justify physical violence, but I've certainly not always been the kindest person with the way I've wielded it and just sort of like witnessing on an actual global scale, the consequences of interpretation of scripture, of stories, of histories, And especially when God's name is brought into it, it's really tough. And I don't really have answers beyond that, just that it's tough.
And I think that that's an okay place to land.
That is the tension of being human.
Yeah.
I just wish I had more power to change things.
Oh, because you would wield the ring correctly.
Right.
Amanda, if it was you.
I'm a tiny god, okay? And this is what I'm
treacherous as the dawn.
You don't know until you let me try, okay? Right. How do you know that I'm not better at handling all of this? I'm a geopolitical genius.
Cast over everyone.
Just haven't given me a chance. Okay.
That's great.
Everyone go around and tell one joke.
Yeah, we do need to end on a lighter note, probably.
I got one for you.
Okay, where, go for it.
Where do rainbows go when they get in trouble?
Oh no. Where?
Where?
Prism.
Nice.
It's a light
a dad joke.
And they get to reflect on their behavior.
Nice.
Is that a Robert original?
I don't know that I have a joke.
No.
I'm not good with jokes off the top of my head.
I do think I have a final thought, sort of like a
okay, yeah.
Something that knits this.
Bring
all
us home, Robert.
Yeah, when you're relying on Robert to take us home, like it's bad.
Tapping out. I'm tapping
this is
out.
Where we are, folks. We are in a bad place. I'm sorry.
I feel too much.
Hector just cuts the episode here and just starts playing just music. No, but so Kate, you were talking about how the distance can really make violence and war feel very impersonal. And I believe that that's also true with the distance of time.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of, there's a word for this or a phrase for this, but there's like this sense of arrogance that we have in our time as we criticize those who lived before us. Like if we had lived in that time, we would have seen things the way that they should have been seen. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is, like you said, Kate, we're still fighting about these same principles in some regard. And while there's, you know, we can look at our modern conflicts and we can fight all day about whose land it is and who has the right to be there and, you know, who has the right to act in one way and who has the right to act in another way and to respond and what's a proportional response. But I just think that what we have lost picture of both in the present and in our reading of this text is that God is on the side of life, that the loss of life and really sitting with that has to be important for us as image bearers. That has to be part of the thing that we're looking at and reflecting on. And that I do want to believe, and I want to end on a cheery note, and I want to be optimistic and say that, you know, there's good news that comes out of the tragedy and that God still sees us, which is true. Like in the smallness of who we are in the big picture of this conflict and all the things that are going on in the world around us, like God still very much sees the one sheep. But at the same time, I think that it's okay to just land and reflect on the lament and the what could have been and what was lost and you know the ways that this the way that it didn't have to be this way. And so I think that reflection is important, and that's also holy as much as our need for optimism. God cares about people. He cares about life.
Yeah. Amanda, anything you're pondering?
No.
No, I know. I don't have anything.
Just a bummer to end on, but Robert, I do think. Yeah, I echo your sentiments that, right? Like, this isn't the way that it's supposed to be. And I think even now, right? Like, this isn't the way the world is not the way that it's supposed to be. And yet there are still these glimmers of people joining in, like, the will of God on earth to bring peace and wholeness. And we can be participants of that in the small ways that we are able to.
Yep. On earth as it is in heaven, you know, that's our motto. And so, yeah, I mean, thanks for hanging with us, everybody. as we wind up in this very sad state.
Yeah. Go just after that, you listen to this. Go watch your favorite.
Please listen to something funny. Watch something happy. Scroll through TikToks of dogs doing cute things. Whatever you need. That's sort of my personal thing. Yeah, and just know, like, if you're feeling heavy about what's going on in the world, you're not alone in that. There is a sense in which we sort of think we have to be happy, and I think that's like I think that's a very American thing, this sort of like positivity bent that we have, this American optimism, and that we can do anything. But I do think there is so much, if you read through the prophets in the Bible, there is so much of God being sad over mistreatment of vulnerable people.
Yeah.
And so being sad about mistreatment of vulnerable people or violence and the way that it's erupted or the loss of life in any way is part of instincts that I think we get from being image bearers. I think those are the things that are built into us so that we care about justice, so that we, you know, reach out and help people. And I think those feelings, while heavy and hard, like you said, Robert, are holy feelings. And so I think as we sit in the tension of where this book ends or where we are in the world and figuring out what that means, or even figuring out, like, sitting in what feels like a battle zone that might be your own heart and mind in your faith, I think there is a sense in which not surrendering to despair and not surrendering to ignoring everything in optimism, and instead standing and being willing to feel and move and participate, right, in the wholeness of yourself and in the world. Like, that is, you know, a radical act. And I think that is a godly act, a godlike, a Christlike act. And so, yeah, take your time and grieve and hold the heavy things, because I think that's part of what we're meant to do here, because it's part of how we recognize that the world isn't as it should be.
Yeah.
And it's part of what drives us to hope and do better. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we'll leave you with today.
Amen.
Thank you so much for joining our discussion today. I hope that you got as much out of it as we always do from these conversations. If you enjoyed it, please leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast player to help more people find the show and learn along with us. And don't forget to find and follow us on social media. All our links are in the show notes, and I can't wait until we see you next time. Bye-bye.